Mission between Shareable, Post Carbon Institute, Transition US, Upstream Podcast, and News Stories. Funding was provided by the Threshold and Shift Foundations. Visit theresponsepodcast.org for transcripts, community resilience resources, and to listen to all other episodes. Making Contact's team is Executive Director Lisa Redman, producer Salima Hamarani, Anita Johnson, and Monica Lopez. Audience Engagement Director, Sabine Blazin. Outreach and Distribution Assistant, Dylan Hoyer. And I'm Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Season is the Reason, Yule Bazaar, on Sunday, December 2nd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the East Portland Eagle Lodge in Portland. The Season is the Reason Yule Bazaar will feature vendors, winter holiday stories, and seasonal pagan celebrations. The bazaar is also a drop-off site for donations for Esther's Pantry, a local organization dedicated to providing food and personal care items to low-income people living with HIV. Again, that's The Season is the Reason, Yule Bazaar, Sunday, December 2nd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the East Portland Eagles Lodge, 4904 Southeast Hawthorne Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm your host, Dab Stedman, and my guest today is Matthew Liebman, who is the Director of Litigation at the Animal Legal Defense Fund. This nonprofit organization works in many ways, but the ALDF is best known for filing high-impact lawsuits to protect animals from harm, and our guest is right in the center of that contentious arena. Welcome to the program, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. Well, the Animal Legal Defense Fund is our nation's preeminent legal advocacy organization for animals. So to start off, can you give us a brief overview of ALDF's main focus areas and then talk a little bit about some of the ways you work to accomplish your goals?
Sure. So, yeah, the Animal Legal Defense Fund was founded in 1979 with the mission of protecting the lives and advancing the interests of animals through the legal systems. And we have more than 200,000 members and supporters across the country. And we do our work in a number of ways, our work to protect animals using the legal system. As you mentioned, We file high-impact civil lawsuits to protect animals in virtually every area where they're exploited, be that factory farming, animal research, the pet trade, captive wild animals, and obviously the list goes on. So we do litigation in all areas of animal exploitation. We also work to make sure that the criminal animal cruelty laws are effectively enforced, ensuring that prosecutors have the resources they need to ensure that those who abuse animals are held accountable. And then we work legislatively to pass or strengthen laws that protect animals or to oppose laws that would harm animals, such as ag-gag laws that criminalize undercover investigations. And we also work to make sure that animal law as a field of inquiry is nurtured. And so we work to with law schools and law students to make sure that animal law is part of the curriculum, so the next generation of lawyers have the opportunity to continue the work of ensuring that the legal system begins to account for the interests of the non-human world.
And do you collaborate with any other organizations?
We do. There are a lot of other groups that we partner with when the context demands it. So we're open to working with environmental groups. We work with groups that are focused on workers' rights and, of course, other animal rights groups as well.
Okay, great. It sounds like the ALDF provides a vast array of services. That's terrific. Well, many people seem to assume that there are adequate legal protections for all animals, and they might wonder just why an organization like yours is necessary. Can you speak to that, please?
Sure, yeah. I mean, sadly, the state of the law right now as it concerns animals is woefully inadequate in virtually every regard. So, you know, it is the case that every state in the country has a criminal animal cruelty law, and those do protect against some of the worst forms of abuse that some animals endure, but those statutes are riddled with exceptions that make life miserable for many of the animals who are the subject of abuse. And that might be, for example, farmed animals who are often victims of horrific cruelty on farms, and yet the animal cruelty laws will exempt them as well. There are a handful of federal laws that protect animals from abuse, things like the Humane Methods Slaughter Act, but that, again, has exemptions that make it inadequate. And so we see animals like chickens, who make up the vast majority of animals who are slaughtered for food, being exempted from those laws as well. Same thing goes in the research context,
yes,
where birds, rats, and mice are exempted from the Animal Welfare Act, even though they make up 95% of the animals used in research. So there are some laws that do protect animals, but they are inadequate in terms of their substance and also inadequate in terms of the extent to which they're enforced by the government. And so it becomes incredibly important for organizations like the Animal Legal Defense Fund to bring our lawyers into these fights to make sure that animals do get protected in creative ways that really force the legal system to consider their interests.
Okay, good. I think our listeners will want to hear about your current court cases, some of which involve animals and businesses right here in Oregon. So let's start with that lawsuit on behalf of Justin, the abused horse who was rescued from his abusive owner in Cornelius, Oregon. Would you please describe that situation and what ALDF has been doing about it? And then tell us why this is such an important legal case for animal law.
Sure. Yeah, this is a really exciting, potentially groundbreaking case that we filed earlier this year. And it concerns a horse named Justice, who was a victim of severe cruelty and neglect. He was left outside in the winter without adequate shelter or food. And when he was rescued last year by a great organization called Sound Equine Options, he was more than 300 pounds underweight. He had what's called a body condition score of 1 out of 9, which is about as emaciated as a horse can be. And most significantly, as a result of his exposure, he had frostbite on his genitals, which have caused him severe and permanent deformation. And as a result of that, his former owner, a woman named Gwendolyn Bircher, was charged with neglect and criminally prosecuted. She reached a plea deal in which she agreed to pay a small amount of restitution to the rescue organization and avoided jail time. But as a result of the injury she inflicted on Justice, he's going to require lifelong veterinary care. And so we filed a lawsuit, not on behalf of the rescue organization, but directly on behalf of Justice himself. He's our client and the plaintiff in the lawsuit. And he's suing his former abuser, essentially for the cost of his veterinary bills, his medical care, and his pain and suffering going forward. And this is really a potentially groundbreaking case because it really raises the question of the extent to which animals are the true victims of animal cruelty crimes. And it's well established that when someone is the victim of a crime, they have a right to sue the person who committed that crime for damages in civil court. And that's essentially what this court, what this case is seeking, is a precedent that would recognize that when animals are the victims of animal cruelty crimes, and when they suffer injuries as a result of that, they should have the right to vindicate the rights that they already have under the animal cruelty laws by suing their abusers in court. And so that's really the goal of this case, is to expand the legal system to recognize animals are victims, which the Oregon courts have already done, and then to expand that to recognize the ability of animals to be plaintiffs in lawsuits, to be legal subjects, as it were.
So how is it moving through the courts at this point? How is it going?
Well, the case was dismissed by the trial court, which was, frankly, a result that we expected. This is a groundbreaking theory, and usually those kinds of questions get resolved by the higher courts. And so the trial court dismissed the case, essentially saying that a horse had no right to be a plaintiff in a lawsuit. They didn't have legal standing. And we are, as soon as the judgment gets issued in that case, we'll be filing an appeal with the Oregon Court of Appeals, urging them to reverse that decision and recognize that animals do, in fact, have the legal right to sue their abusers in court when their rights have been violated.
Okay. Good luck with that. That would be a real groundbreaking change in the law, or the law's attitude, at least. So in terms of another local issue, just about everybody who lives in Portland is familiar with the plant-based food called tofurkey, which is manufactured in nearby Hood River, Oregon. It's a very popular meat substitute around here, but apparently some animal meat producers in Missouri are quite unhappy with it. Can you fill us in on what's been happening in the courts over there?
Yeah, that's right. So tofurkey is a client of the Animal Legal Defense Fund in a case that we filed in Oregon. In Missouri. And Missouri passed a law earlier this year that essentially makes it a crime for anyone to market a product as meat, or essentially to use meat terminology, unless the product comes from a slaughtered animal. And so for a company like tofurkey that sells, you know, veggie sausages or veggie deli slices, as far as Missouri is concerned, they are selling a product that doesn't come from a slaughtered animal as if it were meat. And really, this is an effort by the meat industry and their partners in the Missouri legislature to crack down on the burgeoning plant-based market. You know, there's obviously a growing demand for humane alternatives to animal products, and tofurkey is part of that, and as are many other producers. And I think seeing that these humane alternatives were gaining market share, the industry obviously is getting nervous about that. And you know, one of the responses has been to try to undercut the ability of these producers to market their products in a way that will appeal to consumers. And so,
not that consumers would really, you know, confuse the two products, I wouldn't think.
That's right. That's right. I mean, if there were actual consumer confusion and somebody was buying, almond milk thinking it contained cow milk, or buying tofurkey sausages thinking they were coming from a pig, that would be one thing. But obviously, plant-based producers have an interest in making sure that consumers understand that these are products that don't contain slaughtered animals, and that makes them actually more desirable. It means they're produced humanely. It means they're potentially healthier. It means they have a smaller environmental footprint. And so the idea that there's actual consumer confusion about this is ridiculous. And so representing tofurkey, we filed a lawsuit saying that this law in Missouri, which prohibits companies like tofurkey from describing their products, is unconstitutional under the First Amendment and violates their right to speak truthfully to people about what their product is and how it should be used.
And has there been a decision on that case yet?
No, that case is still in the early stages. It's only recently been filed, so nothing to report there, although we are optimistic. And we've partnered with the Good Food Institute as well as the ACLU of Missouri in that case, so a good coalition of organizations are fighting to ensure that law.
Yeah, and it's interesting that a non-animal organization is jumping in with you, to side with you. I think that really bolsters, the case and the weight of it as well.
It does, yeah, and we've had a great working relationship with the ACLU and various state chapters. In terms of litigating cases where there's an overlap between free speech, civil liberties issues, and animal protection issues.
Okay. We're going to take just a brief break now, so don't go away. We're back, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. We've been talking with Matthew Liebman, the Director of Litigation at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, about some of the lawsuits they've made on behalf of animals recently. So, Matthew, another legal issue affecting animals in the Northwest and elsewhere as well involves the so-called ag-gag laws. I can barely say it. Please explain what these laws are and why they're so harmful in so many ways.
So these are these ag-gag laws are laws that have been passed in 9 states across the country that essentially prohibit people from conducting undercover investigations at agricultural facilities, and that might be factory farms or slaughterhouses. And this has been another way in which the meat industry has tried to crack down on the animal rights movement. I think, as probably many of your listeners know, there have been dozens and dozens of undercover investigations at these facilities over the last 10 or 15 years, and every single one reveals violence against animals that really would turn most people's stomachs. They reveal not only sort of sadistic incidents of animal cruelty, but also practices that are routine and pervasive throughout the industry. Things like routine mutilations, intensive confinement, things that are inherent in the production of animal products, things like separating baby calves from their mothers. And so the response of the industry, rather than reforming objectionable practices, has been to kill the messenger. And they've done that by passing these laws, convincing legislatures to pass these laws that make it a crime or create extensive civil liability for anyone who conducts an undercover investigation and goes undercover with a hidden camera to document the abuse of animals at farms or slaughterhouses. And so we have challenged these statutes under the First Amendment, arguing that really the purpose of these statutes is to silence half of the debate on an issue of significant public concern. Obviously, a lot of people care about these, the treatment of animals, care about food safety issues, worker safety issues, and efforts to silence them by preventing them from doing undercover investigations and exposés runs afoul of the free speech clause of the First Amendment and the whole idea of having an open, honest conversation about how animals are treated on factory farms. And we've had quite a bit of success. We filed lawsuits in Idaho, Utah, Iowa, and North Carolina, and we've won the cases in Utah, made significant progress in Idaho earlier this year when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down important parts of that state's ag gag laws, and then have cases pending in Iowa and North Carolina, and more to come as well. So this has been a long, years-long battle for us, but one that we think is extremely important in order to really protect the ability of activists and other organizations.
Right, and not only activists and animals' well-being, but if whistleblowing at animal operations is outlawed, then what's to stop this type of information blackout from spreading to other areas of commerce like elder care or hospitals or even schools? So it's a big issue overall, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, two states, Arkansas and North Carolina, have passed statutes that ban undercover investigations across the board, not only at animal facilities. So it's really, I think, a threat to transparency across the board.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, have any animal activists or investigative journalists been jailed under ag-gag statutes yet?
So, yes, there have been a few prosecutions. There was a woman named Amy Meyer, who is one of our plaintiffs in our Utah case, who was filming a slaughterhouse in Utah from a public road, and she wasn't jailed, but she was ultimately prosecuted for violating the ag gag law. Unfortunately, fortunately, those charges were ultimately dismissed when she was able to prove that she was on public property and not trespassing, but I think it does illustrate the danger that these laws pose to on-the-ground activists like Amy.
Definitely. And I do understand that many courts and legislatures have not been sympathetic to ag-gag laws in their jurisdictions, and that either the legislatures have failed to pass statutes like this, or laws that were passed have been declared unconstitutional later on. So has this type of pushback discouraged other places from trying to enact ag-gag legislation in their own locales?
I think so. We have had great success legislatively, and I think the animal rights movement has successfully mobilized people in many states. So most of the ag gag bills that have been introduced haven't passed because of the public opposition that has come up. And that, I think, is a testament to what can happen when the movement collaborates and coordinates and really sort of recognizes the dire threat that these kinds of laws pose and work together to mobilize our members and supporters to speak out and ensure that these laws don't get passed.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you're totally on top of the situation. I've read on your website recently about the legal battle that's being waged by ADLF, and I think maybe in collaboration with some other organizations, against the College of Optometry at the State University of New York, known as SUNY. The experiments that they've been performing on kittens there for years are really, they sound painful and almost gruesome, but what are the legal issues involved there?
Yeah, so this is a case that we filed recently. We're representing a group called CARE, C-A-A-R-E, which is an organization that is dedicated to fighting the abuse of animals in animal research. And they have been trying to get records, public records, related to these experiments. And yet the State University of New York College of Optometry has refused to turn over those records. And this is something that we face a lot. Fortunately, there are federal and state laws that create the opportunity for citizens to gain access to records that the government has in its possession in order to foster transparency and educate people about what the government is doing with people's tax dollars and so on. And these are can be a powerful tool for animal rights activists to find out what's going on. And that's exactly what CARE wanted to do, to find out sort of the details of these really horrific and gruesome experiments on cats. And I'll spare your listeners some of the details, but they cause immense amounts of pain and suffering. And so to get to the bottom of that, to be able to educate their members, to be able to do outreach to legislators in New York, to talk to other constituencies about these issues, CARE wanted to have these records. And so they requested them under New York's version of the Freedom of Information Act and were denied. And so we're representing CARE alongside a law firm called Meyer, Glitzenstein and Eubanks.
And on what grounds were they denied, may I ask?
Yeah, so there's sort of a convoluted, trumped-up claim that these records would be used to harass researchers, even though CARE has a strong commitment to nonviolence and to changing research, not through threats of violence, but through educating the public. So essentially, SUNY said, well, if we give you these records, then you'll use them to harass our researchers, which would be further from the truth.
And let me ask you, you mentioned that taxpayer money is being used to fund these horrific experiments on kittens and cats, but has any useful information relevant to human vision come out of all of this so-called research?
No, not to our knowledge. These are experiments that have been going on in one form or another for more than 30 years, and yet SUNY can't point to any concrete benefit for humans.
Oh boy, I tell you, sometimes it's pretty discouraging, but I'm just so thankful for an organization like yours that is bringing light to a very dark situation. Well, we have a couple of minutes left, Matthew, so before we run out of time today, can you suggest some ways that our listeners can support the work of the Animal Legal Defense Fund?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So we do have action alerts that people can sign up for on our website. As I mentioned, you know, there are issues where the voice of the public really matters, and reaching out to your legislators can be one of those. So we encourage people to sign up for action alerts on our website. You can also make a donation to support our work. Obviously, litigation and court cases, those don't come cheap, and so we can use your support. And then, of course, we have a social media presence on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, where you can also become active and help spread the word about the cases we're doing and the exploitation that we're fighting.
Okay. And for starters, do you happen to know your website address?
Yeah, I should mention that. It's alds.org.
Oh, that's easy. Okay. I do have another question. If I or a friend of mine or whatever, anyone who has a situation where they think that they need to talk with an attorney who is well-versed in animal case law, how would they go about finding a lawyer like that?
Yeah, so it really depends. And the nature of the Animal Legal Defense Fund, we don't generally take referrals from the public. We don't give referrals to other attorneys. Our work is what's called strategic impact litigation. So we're sort of picking and choosing our cases based on kind of the high impact thing. So if someone has an individualized dispute that relates to animals, the best bet would be to contact their local bar association and look into contacting a lawyer in your area that might be able to help you. And of course, if it's a criminal matter, if you witness animal abuse or something like that, we encourage people to contact law enforcement or your local humane society to get that investigated as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you. We have just a minute left. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up at this point or tell us what you're working on?
Well, I think we covered most of it, but yeah, as I mentioned, I think the legal system is a really important piece of the puzzle. Obviously, law can't change everything, and especially when a lot of the abuses of animals have been legalized. But I think it's an incredibly powerful way to change behavior, and it's also a really important way to educate the public. We try to do that through our cases, whether that's, you know, in our AGAG cases, even though it's not technically about the treatment of animals, it's about, you know, the First Amendment and the rights of activists, it's a good opportunity to educate people about the horrors of factory farming. And so by working in collaboration with the social movement for animal rights, I think the legal approach is one that is incredibly important, and we appreciate you giving us the opportunity to talk about our work.
Well, I appreciate your coming on the program. We're just about out of time now, so I do want to thank you, Matthew Liebman, for being on the program today and for being a loud and effective legal voice for abused animals everywhere. And thanks to our listeners as well. If you've missed an episode of Voices for the Animals, podcasts of all our programs are available on the station's website at kbu.fm. And please plan to tune in again on the fourth Monday of next month. Until then, remember that you too can be a voice for the animals.
Everybody, I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Stand by for the noontime jamboree.
Come on, come on, come on, come on.
The traveling blues boy, oh, that's what they call me. My home's the desert or the sea. The hills are green valleys, traveling always down a different way, not knowing where or when I'll find a peaceful day. Pretty baby,